Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 7. I will call this chapter, Job Continues, My Life Has No Hope. Our context is this. In our previous chapter, Job has begun his reply to his false friend Eliphaz, and we called chapter 6, My Complaint Is Just. So this is basically a continuation of Job justifying his right in complaining about what's happened to him. And saying that, look, I didn't have anything to do with this. I didn't sin to cause all this suffering that I'm undergoing. Job is replying in response to a speech by Eliphaz, which speech was given in Job 4 and Job 5, where Eliphaz is basically accusing Job, saying, look, the innocent prosper, you're not prospering, therefore you're not innocent. So we begin now in Job 7, verses 1 through 5. Is not man forced to labor on earth, and are not his days like the days of a hired man? As a slave who pants for the shade, and as a hired man who eagerly waits for his wages, so am I allotted months of vanity, and nights of trouble are appointed me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise? But the night continues, and I am continually tossing until dawn. My flesh is clothed with worms and a crust of dirt. My skin hardens and runs. So Job starts out comparing his miserable life to either a slave or a hired laborer who longs for payday for when he gets to get off work. Now, that might seem like a trite comparison, but I've done manual labor before, and I'm telling you, I understand the feeling well. Oh, when will it be Friday so I can get out of here? The slave pants for the shade. He wants the end of the day so his work will be over, and Job wants the end of his trial to be over. But instead, he's allotted months of vanity. Payday's usually once a week. Well, Job has got to go months and months and months with no end in sight. Then he compares his trouble to nighttime. When you lie down, you expect the day to arise so you can get up and go about your business, but it never comes. Day never comes. The night continues. He's continually tossing until dawn because day never arrives. Relief from his suffering never comes. Then in verse 5, Job says, my flesh is clothed with worms. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, that means there were maggots in his sores. Actually, maggots are good for sores. They eat up bacteria. But still, the thought of it is disgusting. My flesh is clothed with worms and a crust of dirt. I say that. I'm no doctor. I've just read that somewhere. Personally, I'd prefer them not to be in any of my sores. So Job says his flesh is a crust of dirt. He can't take a bath. His skin is nothing but one big boil. His skin hardens and runs. As the NIV puts it, his skin is broken and festering. Runs with pus is what it's talking about. Crusty, and then all of a sudden, crack, and the pus comes out. And basically what Job is saying here, I've got a right to complain. Job 7, verses 6 through 10, we continue. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle, Job continues, and come to an end without hope. My days come to an end without hope. Remember that my life is but breath. My eye will not again see good. The eye of him who sees me will behold me no longer. Your eyes will be on me, but I will not be. When a cloud vanishes, it is gone. So he who goes down to Sheol does not come up. He will not return again to his house, nor will his place know him any more. Now, in verses 6 through 10, Job is basically saying, I'm getting ready to die and disappear from this earth, and nobody's going to remember me. Now, we have a couple of metaphors that could contradict each other if we're not careful. In the first five verses, we talked about a long nighttime. And here in verses 6 through 7, we're talking about days that are over quickly. Well, what the days are referring to here are Job's former days of prosperity. They pass quickly, but the nights of suffering pass slowly. And each day passes swiftly, and it comes to the end of the day with no hope. The passing of the days quickly is symbolized by a weaver's shuttle. The NIV Study Bible says this about a shuttle, a weaver's shuttle. Quote, an instrument used with a loom to weave the cross, the woof, threads of a piece of fabric between the warp threads held lengthwise in the loom. The speed with which a weaver throws the shuttle from one side to the other is a striking illustration of the passing of life. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen movies where people are working on these ancient looms. It's amazing. They knock that shuttle left, right across the vertical woof threads as they weave the woof threads through there. I've always been amazed at how they do that with this ancient technology, but it's a perfect analogy because it's moving so fast, just like Job's days are. his days of prosperity, which have come to an end without hope. In verse 8, Job says, "The eye of him who sees me will behold me no longer." In other words, Job's getting ready to disappear because he's dead, so people who are looking at him now will not be able to see him anymore. Then he says, "Your," this is referring to God. It's either referring to God or it's referring to Eliphaz and his friends. I'm not sure which. "Your eyes will be on me, but I will not be." The NIV has, "You will look for me, but you're not going to find me." Why? Because he's dead. Verse 9, "When a cloud vanishes, it is gone, so he goes down to Sheol, does not come up." Sheol, of course, is the grave. It's the Hebrew equivalent of the Greek word Hades, which means the shadowy world of the dead or just the grave. And what that means is that once you croak, you don't come back and live a life on this earth. Now, this does not mean that Job does not believe in the resurrection of the dead. I think this verse is famous for those who love to talk about annihilationism and we're not going to resurrect at the end. Bunch of nonsense. That's not what Job meant here. It just meant that once you die, all this land of sheep and cattle and houses and farms and labor and sitting at the gate and all that, that's over with. Verse 10, "He will not return again to his house." His domestic comforts, over with. "Nor will his place know him anymore." His house, his farms, his fields, his estate, and his possessions, as John Gill put it, they're not going to know who Job is. So Job is basically saying he is finished. He has no hope of the future, nothing. And so he's got a right to complain. Job 7, verses 11 through 16. Job continues. Now, I'm going to assume that Job is continuing now to talk to God now. That's because the NASB capitalizes all the U's, which would mean God. And in a few of these situations, the context will show it's God, too, although sometimes it's ambiguous. The Holman Christian Study Bible also uses capital YU's, too. So this is Job talking to God. Verse 11, "Therefore I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I the sea or the sea monster that you set a guard over me? If I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you, Yahweh, you frighten me with dreams and terrify me by visions, so that my soul would choose suffocation, death rather than my pains. I waste away. I will not live forever. Leave me alone, for my days are but a breath." So Job says, look, I'm not going to hold back. I'm going to complain. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. I've got a right to complain because I don't understand what's happening to me here. Now, God later on is going to say, no, Job, you don't have a right to complain. So Job, remember, he's faithful with his integrity that he does not deny God. He knows God exists. He knows who God is. He's right about that, but he complains to God, and God's going to later say, no, Job, shouldn't have done that. Now, Job complains to God, am I the sea or the sea monster? Why would one set a guard over the sea? Am I the sea or the sea monster that you set a guard over me? Why would God put a guard over the sea? Well, the sea is often a metaphor for sinners, as John Gill puts it, to which very wicked, profligate, and abandoned sinners are compared, that are continually casting up the mire and dirt of sin and wickedness. Well, if the sea is a place of sin, it needs to have a guard over it. And if there's a sea monster in the sea, another good symbol of sin and evil, somebody needs to guard that sea monster. And so Job is saying to God, am I a monster? Am I a sinful monster that you've got to guard me by putting all this calamity on me? As Adam Clark says, the sea monster is regarded in the Old Testament poetry as a violent rebel against God. Am I a violent rebel against God that you've got to guard over me? Job says. It's not only the sea monster that's dangerous, but the sea itself is dangerous when there's a hurricane or a tsunami or something. And so then, is Job stirring up the sea causing danger to the world? That God's got to make him suffer so much to put a guard over him? Verse 14, Job continues, then you, God, most probably, you, Yahweh, frighten me with dreams and terrify me by visions. Now, there is an option as to who is frightening Job with dreams and visions. It could be God, as I just said, as the NIV Study Bible and the New American Standard Bible has it. The New American Standard Bible has you capitalized, meaning it's you, God, frightening Job with visions. Now, the context favors this. Verse 12, Job says, why did you set a guard over me? Well, that obviously is God because Eliphaz is not going to be putting a guard over the sea, so it's God there in verse 12. Why not also in verse 14 according to context? But now you have a problem. Why would God be sending dreams and visions to Job? Nightmares. Well, I think this is indirect, since God is allowing all of this suffering to happen to Job. Job dreams about it, so indirectly God would be responsible for it, so I don't have a problem with that. But there's some other options as to who is frightening Job with his dreams. John Gill suggests dreams that Job himself dreamed. In other words, you are frightening me with my own dream. You dreams are frightening me. Well, that's unlikely. It says you sent the dreams. Doesn't say the dream sent the dreams. And then Job would be giving God the blame for Job's own dreams. I don't think so. That doesn't make any sense. Option number three, Satan. Then you, Satan. Well, sure, Satan could be sending bad dreams. That happens all the time, even today. But there's no context here. Satan is not even mentioned anywhere in the context. That's not it. But now here's an option that might be an option that's applicable, reasonable, an option that's not God sending the visions. It could refer to a dream that Eliphaz had told Job about. This was in Job chapter 4, verses 13 through 17. I'll read it to you. This is Eliphaz speaking now. Amid disquieting thoughts from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falls on men, dread came upon me and trembling, and made all my bones shake. Then a spirit passed by my face. The hair of my flesh bristled up. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes. There was silence. Then I heard a voice. Can mankind be just before God? Can a man be pure before his Maker? Now, we don't know what that spirit was that Eliphaz was dreaming about. It could have been Satan. It could have been God. But whatever it was, that dream was creepy. And Eliphaz told it to Job. And so Job could have been saying, then you, Eliphaz, you frighten me with your dreams. That makes a lot of sense to me. Remember, the you does not have to be capitalized. That's not in the original text. That's a translator's choice. Verse 15, Job continues, so that my soul would choose suffocation, death, rather than my pains. Now, notice the would there, the subjunctive, the hypothetical. My soul would choose suffocation if he had a choice. He doesn't have a choice because suicide is never contemplated by Job, which is an amazing thing because I'll tell you what, just like I live post-apocalypse in The Walking Dead, I would have been very tempted for suicide. And Job, with what happened to him, he would be a prime candidate for suicide. But that thought never crossed his mind. He did, however, wish that he could voluntarily die, that God would just cut him off. Suicide by God, if you will. If he were contemplating suicide, he would have done it by now, or very shortly hereafter. Now, verse 16 in the NASB might be a little confusing. Job says, I waste away. I will not live forever. Well, obviously, Job's not going to live forever. Nobody does. So what does Job mean here? John Gill says it means that he doesn't want to live a long time. In other words, I do not will to live forever. I do not want to live forever. Big difference in understanding when you read it that way. He wants to die quickly. The NIV has it, I would not live forever, i.e., I do not want to live forever. Well, he's lost all desire to live. He wants to die. Leave me alone, for my days are but a breath. We go now to Job chapter 7, verses 17 through 19. What is man that you magnify him? Again, we're still talking to God. Job is talking to God. And that you are concerned about him, that you examine him every morning and try him every moment. Will you never turn your gaze away from me, nor let me alone until I swallow my spittle? That's why I think the you there all the way through this chapter is referring to God, because of the context. These yous obviously refer to God, that Job is speaking to God. And so then, going back to verse 14, when Job says, then you frighten me with dreams, that's talking about God. It's probably not talking about Eliphaz's dream. I didn't really make that clear in my opinion. What is man that you magnify him? In verse 17, some see this as a parody on Psalm 8, verse 4, which says this, what is man that you take thought of him, and the son of man that you care for him? There's a similar psalm in Psalm 144:3. O Lord, what is man that you take knowledge of him, or the son of man that you think of him? Now, those psalms are saying, oh God, man is such a wonderful creation that you, the great God, condescend, you deign to kneel down and deal with man. So man must be made just a little lower than the angels, as it says in another place. But that's not the way Job is putting it. He's saying, what is man that you magnify him? Man is nothing. Why are you concerned about him? Nothing. The Psalms, when they say what is man, they're saying that God is constantly watching man to take care of him. Job is saying that God is constantly watching men to try him. Why are you concerned about in verse 18 that you examine him every morning and try him every moment? Was Job right in saying that God is trying to torture Job every minute? No, he wasn't. He was speaking as a deeply despondent man who longed for death, as the NIV Study Bible points out. His bitterness burst out. Verse 19, Job says, "Will you never turn your gaze away from me, nor let me alone until I swallow my spittle?" That's a literal translation from the NASB, swallow my spittle. It's a proverb that means a short period of time, if you take it proverbially, which I think it is. The NIV translates it as, let me alone even for an instant. Will you never let me alone even for an instant? Why? Because it doesn't take long to swallow your spit. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates verse 19 as this, will you ever look away from me or leave me alone long enough to swallow? Leave me alone, God. I want you to scram because you're killing me. That's basically what it's saying. It could be that swallow my spittle is not meant to be taken in an idiomatic fashion, but is meant to be taken literally. Job could be referring to the fact that his sickness prevented him from swallowing. Literally, I can't swallow. We go down to Job 7, verses 20 through 21. Job continues complaining to God. Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust, and you will seek me, but I will not be. Now verse 20 is, have I sinned? That's the NASB translation. The NIV and the Holman Christian Study Bible say, if I have sinned, what have I done to you? The KJV says, I have sinned. The KJV translation presents a problem, because Job has just spent a lot of energy asserting his innocence, and all of a sudden now he says, God, I've sinned. Well, if you take it this way, you have to explain it, and here's how you can explain it. Job is saying, look, I'm a sinner like everybody else is a sinner. Everybody else is a sinner, but they don't go through the grief and calamity that I'm going through. So how is my sin large enough to account for the degree of my suffering? I'm a sinner, but what have I done to you to have all this happen to me? Well, I prefer the NASB, have I sinned? In other words, since it's obvious that I haven't sinned, you might as well pronounce me clean. I think that's a much better understanding of it. Adam Clark says this in agreement, quote, if I have sinned, then why should not I have a part in that mercy that flows so freely to all mankind? In other words, I've sinned, but what have I done to not get forgiveness for my sin? The rest of mankind gets forgiveness for sins. Well, you avoid all that possible confusion just by avoiding the King James translation and just say, if I've sinned, what have I done to you? In other words, I haven't sinned. Job is not saying that he's sinned in the sense of having done something to cause all this grief. Here's what Clark says about Job allegedly admitting that he has sinned in order to cause all of his suffering. Clark says this, quote, that Job does not criminate himself here, incriminate is what we would say today, that Job does not criminate himself here, as our text intimates, is evident enough from his own repeated assertions of his innocence. And it is most certain that Bildad, who immediately answers in the next chapter, Bildad did not consider him as criminating, but as justifying himself. And this is the very ground on which he takes up the subject. Were we to admit the contrary, in other words, if we were to admit that Job is confessing his sin, we should find strange inconsistencies, if not contradictions, in Job's speeches. On such a ground, the controversy must have immediately terminated, as he would then have acknowledged that of which his friends accused him. And here, the book of Job would have ended. So, there's no question Job is not confessing that he has sinned in any way to cause all of this stuff to come upon him. Now, there's a translation here. There is a translation issue here. Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? The NIV says, have I become a burden to you? Job says, why have you set me as a target, God, so that I have become a burden to you, not to myself? The NIV note says that most manuscripts of the Masoretic text have, I have become a burden to myself. And so that's the way we're going to take it. That's the way the NASB takes it. The NIV note also says a few manuscripts of the Masoretic text and ancient Hebrew scribal tradition and the Septuagint have I become a burden to you. Doesn't make any difference. It's a minor point. Either way, Job's a burden, either to God or to himself. The Holman Christian Study Bible takes the Septuagint way and says, if I have sinned, what have I done to you, watcher of mankind? Why have you made me your target so that I have become a burden to you? Job finishes up this chapter by saying in verse 21, "Why then do you not pardon my transgression?" Job felt like he must have sinned somehow, else he would not be suffering, so he asked for forgiveness, even though he's not conscious that he's done anything wrong. So he's sort of buying into the premises of his friends. Well, things are bad. I must have done something to offend God, but I sure don't know what it is. So he's putting himself under condemnation, which just adds to his suffering. I tell you, it's hard to study these chapters of Job closely without getting a little bit down. Well, hopefully the next chapter might cheer us up a little bit. I doubt it, but the next chapter is Job chapter 8, verses 1 through 22, which I will call Bildad Speaks. Job should repent. Repent, you sinner. That's why you're suffering. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you will bear with me in the next chapter, chapter 8, and I hope that somehow you enjoyed this audio.